In the previous chapter, I told you that the fact that water is a polar molecule is why you exist, basically, in all organisms. This chapter is devoted to water and various special properties that it has that make it conducive to life evolving. But even though we're going to go through different properties, all of them really stem from the fact that water is polar. None of the properties that we're going to talk about would be the way they are if it weren't for the fact that water is a polar molecule. And so, what does it mean to be polar, first of all, a polar molecule? Yeah, well, to be a polar molecule means that the bonds in that molecule are polar. And for a bond to be polar means that the sharing of the electrons that make it a covalent bond is an unequal sharing. And what is it that makes it a sharing unequal? A difference in the values of the electronegativities of the two atoms involved. Which is why if you have two identical atoms, two oxygens, for instance, or two of any of the same type of atom, that's always going to be a nonpolar covalent bond. Because it doesn't matter what the value of the electronegativities are, they're the same for the two identical atoms. But whenever you have two atoms that are different, it could be either polar or nonpolar, depending on what those values of the electronegativity are. Now, they might not, if it's two different atoms, they might not be exactly equal. But if they're really close, that's still going to end up being classified as a nonpolar bond. When they're pretty different, though, it's going to be a fairly drastically unequal sharing, which means that that bond is going to be polar. And that's the case when oxygen and hydrogen get together. The value of electronegativity for oxygen is much higher than that for hydrogen. And that's what a water molecule is. It's made up of two oxygen-hydrogen bonds. Right? So both of the two bonds in water, in a single water molecule, are polar. And since oxygen's value for electronegativity is much higher, it's the atom in the shared arrangement that wins out with respect to how much time the electrons spend around it. And that's why the oxygen end of the individual bond between oxygen and one hydrogen is slightly negative. And that's why the hydrogen end of that same bond is slightly positive, because it doesn't have those electrons there very often. And just as I was talking about in the water ammonia example in that previous chapter, if the population is all water molecules, the same thing happens. Each individual molecule, when it approaches another polar molecule, is going to swivel so that its slightly negative end is adjacent to the slightly positive end of the next molecule. And therefore, a population of polar molecules, like water molecules, is slightly less chaotic or disordered than a population of nonpolar molecules would be. They would just be bouncing off of each other, not attracted. Okay? And that fact, that polarity of water and the formation of hydrogen bonds between them, gives water some remarkable properties compared to other things. So let's start looking at some properties. Slide 2. Here we have a plant, pretty big tree, but this is true of any vascular plant. Like it doesn't have to be a tree, but anyway, there is a continuous flow of water entering the plant at the roots, traveling upward through its body, and then exiting at the leaves. That's not why they're called leaves, because it's leaving there, but anyway. That continuous movement of water is called transpiration. which is not really the point of this slide, but that's what it's called. And that happens plants of all sizes, but it's a one-way movement upward, away from gravity. In other words, and the reason this is able to happen is because, like all these properties in this chapter, is because water is polar. But you should appreciate how difficult this is, especially the bigger the plant gets. Now, what are the tallest trees? Giant redwoods, the sequoias. Not only the biggest trees in the United States, not only the biggest trees right now, not only the biggest trees that have ever existed, they're the biggest organisms that have ever existed. Far bigger than dinosaurs. But they're also big vertically. They're really tall, obviously. And the same thing is happening in them. Water has to go all the way to the top of a sequoia. Well, that is... Yeah, go ahead.
Is this a new chapter? Or is this continuing off the last one? Is this a new...
Well, it was a new one when I switched to this slideshow.
Okay.
Yeah. If you think about your own experience with water, which is usually to get it from a faucet. You know, you're used to turning a spigot and having the water come out. Why does it come out, by the way?
I don't know.
Never thought about it?
Mm-hmm.
Just expect it to, right?
Yeah.
Well, it comes out because of a pressure gradient. There's higher pressure inside the pipe than outside, and therefore when you open the valve, water goes from the higher pressure to the lower pressure, comes outward. But then that asks the question, why is there a pressure gradient? Why is it pressurized to begin with? It's not because your house has a pump continuously running, causing pressure. Pressure is everywhere in the city. Any spigot you open. What pressurizes the water? No idea? Well, what is it? No. I mean, it's a component of it chemically, but that's not what gives it the pressure. If you have an IV bag sitting on the ground next to a person that the needle's hooked into, and you want to speed up delivery of that liquid, whatever it is in the IV bag, into that patient, what do you do? Well, you could squeeze it, yeah. Yeah, you would pick it up, make it higher, right? So that it will fall downhill into the human. Yes, gravity causes the pressure. And this is because the storage tanks for the city are higher than the houses. You know, when you go to the plain states that don't have any hills, you see water towers every so often. Tanks of water that are taller than houses. So that no matter which house it is, the water is falling downhill. If you have a skyscraper, on the other hand, way tall, you know, around here we have water towers on mesas, still taller than houses. But you can have a taller building than the tallest water tower in the city. and turn the spigot, nothing's going to happen, right? Just like you could take the tube of an IV bag, take the needle off of it, so it's just an empty tube, and if you lift that higher than the bag itself, nothing's coming out, right? So skyscrapers need their own dedicated pumps to move water against gravity, which takes a lot of energy to get it to the top for them to have a water supply. Well, sequoias are like skyscrapers, but there aren't any electrical pumps running continuously to get the water up to the top of them. I just say that to get you to appreciate how much energy it actually takes to move water, a column of water, against gravity that far up into the away from the surface of the earth. It's an enormous amount of energy required. And that force is caused by hydrogen bonds between water and water molecules, and between water molecules and the interior of the tubes, the little xylem tubes that make up the vessels of the tree that water flows through. So there's really two forces involved here. They are called cohesive force or cohesion and adhesive force or adhesion. Very similar. It's really the same things happening, but we give them two names depending on what is involved. Adhesion is force of attraction between two different types of things. This is why we call it adhesive tape, if it sticks to something else. Cohesion is the force of attraction between particles of the same type rather than different. And so we just got done saying that there's water is polar, so when you have a population of water molecules, there's hydrogen bonds between them. And you have a representation of water molecules within a narrow vessel of the tree, shown here on the right. Well, this is very similar to a train. A train is made up of many cars, right? Each one is linked to the one behind it. The engine is the only thing that's pulling, I mean, that has a motor, but everything else moves behind it because they're all linked, right? So this column of water in the tube is made up of individual water molecules that are like the cars of a train. Each one of them is attracted to the one above it, and the one down here is attracted to the second one, and so on, all the way down to the roots. Each individual hydrogen bond isn't very strong at all. But that's what's caused, you know, that keeps the integrity of the whole line of water molecules. And that's cohesion because it's water to water. But there's also adhesive force because of hydrogen bonding with water molecules to the molecules that make up the wall of the tube. And as water molecules are leaving the leaves, going out into the air, like taking away the engine of the train, then the next one becomes the new engine, and it's attracted a little bit more upwardly because of cohesion with the walls, and then everything, all the water molecules follow behind by cohesion because of the hydrogen bonding. Well, using the train analogy again, if you break the link between cars somewhere in the middle of the train, only that first part of the train is going to keep going, right? The rest of it is going to just stop. And similarly, if you break these hydrogen bonds somewhere in the middle, that's going to form a bubble in the tube, and it's going to kill the tree eventually if that happens a lot of places. But why would that happen? Well, the longer you make this train, the more and more you're stressing those hydrogen bonds, right? Because the more and more gravity there is, the higher you get. Just like if you lift up a chain with almost all the links on the floor at first, it's not very heavy, but it gets a little heavier the more links you have off of the floor. If you get a tree too high, gravity will win out, and it'll break the train, basically. And it's probable that sequoias have evolved to be about as high as any tree can be and still have transpiration. Let's go on to three now and talk about this animal that is walking on water. It's walking on the surface of the water rather than sinking, even though it's more dense than water. You know, typically if you put something more dense than the liquid itself into a liquid, it's going to fall to the bottom. But it's not. It's walking on the surface, and you can see that the surface is indented at each of its legs, which makes it look like there's a skin on the water. And it's actually more than it just looks that way. There actually is a thicker thickness to the water, or a denseness to the water at the surface compared to the deeper water makes it act like a skin, even though it's made out of the same stuff, water molecules. And once again, this is because of hydrogen bonding, but let me draw a little cartoon to hopefully explain that. If we just consider a vessel of water, like a beaker or whatever, the individual water molecules are dots, and you have a certain thickness to the water, depth. At depth, meaning anywhere except the surface, the water molecules are pretty much evenly distributed, and that's because they're attracted by hydrogen bonding to each other, and deeper than the surface, any given water molecule is basically being pulled in all directions, right? But if you consider the water molecules at the very surface, they also forming hydrogen bonds, but they're being pulled only from underneath. There aren't water molecules above them. So that means the first few layers of water molecules are more compressed than the ones at depth, where they're being pulled in all directions. And that actually makes it a skin of water. It's denser and therefore can withstand the footprints of this water walker. Slide 4 now. Can we stop? Yeah, okay, we've got about 10 minutes. There's a couple important things I want to say that this map reminds me of. The map, by the way, it doesn't matter at all where we are in the world, but we have a big body of water and a big body of land right next to it. Well, I want to define a couple important properties that the map reminds me of. And the first of those is specific heat capacity. Any given substance has a certain value of what we call specific heat capacity. Not just water. You can put a value to any substance. But the specific heat capacity is the amount of energy required to raise the temperature of 1 gram of that stuff by 1 Kelvin, or 1 degree centigrade, which is the same thing, same size. And any given substance will have a number for its, a value for its specific heat capacity. The higher that number is, the harder it is to heat that stuff, right? Because it takes more energy to raise it 1 degree compared to something with a lower specific heat capacity. And go ahead. Yeah, the specific heat capacity is the amount of energy required to raise 1 gram of a substance by 1 Kelvin. Not all substances are equal. Compared to most substances, water's specific heat capacity is pretty high, which means water is harder to heat than most things. This is why we have the old adage that a watched pot never boils. If you're in a hurry and you're trying to watch for that boiling, it seems like it takes forever if it's water. And that's because water has a high specific heat capacity. It's not going to boil until you first heat that whole batch of water as many degrees as is necessary to get it to the boiling point, right? Why is water hard to heat? Has a high specific heat capacity? Well, like all of these properties in this chapter, it boils down to the fact that it's a polar molecule. To heat something, to increase its temperature, remember the definition of temperature, means that you have to speed up its particles, right? Well, compared to a nonpolar population of molecules, or a population of nonpolar molecules, a population of polar molecules are going to be a little resistant to speeding up because of these little attractions, like magnetic forces, only it's not magnetic. So some of the heat that you're delivering goes into simply breaking the hydrogen bond before it can then get sped off. Does that make sense? On the other hand, if you have oil, cooking oil versus pure water in a pot, you deliver exactly the same amount of heat to exactly the same mass of oil compared to water, it's going to get hot a hell of a lot quicker. Its temperature is going to go up a lot more with that same amount of heat as a lower specific heat capacity. So on a global scale, this means large bodies of water heat and cool less drastically on a 24-hour cycle. You know, you have energy coming in as sunlight. That energy is delivered to both the lake, ocean, or pond as it is to the land mass. But the land has a lower specific heat capacity. The water mass has a higher specific heat capacity. So they're getting equal energy input, but the ocean's going to go up just very slightly in temperature during the day, down very slightly at night. Land's going to get much hotter during the day and much cooler at night. This is why swimming pools seem so warm at night when you're cold. This is one reason why life started out in the oceans. And for billions of years, for most of life's history, that's the only place there was life. We tend to forget that because we're terrestrial organisms. But that's kind of a recent thing. Last 700 million years or so was when the only time we've had life on land. It's been in the ocean the whole time, exclusively before that. But it's a more stable environment, thermally speaking. That's one reason. Another, though, property is latent heat of vaporization. Now, vaporization is really just another name for evaporation, meaning transformation of liquid into gas. And just like specific heat capacity is a property of any given substance, also any given substance has a latent heat of vaporization. But it's defined as the amount of energy required to transform 1 gram of that stuff from liquid to gas. In other words, to evaporate 1 gram of it. And the values, of course, different from substance to substance. And just like for specific heat capacity, water's value for latent heat of vaporization is higher than most other substances. So not only is it hard to heat because of the specific heat capacity to get it up to boiling, it's also hard to make it evaporate. Once again, this is because of hydrogen bonding. If you think back to this beaker we were looking at for a different reason, That's a population of water molecules. And remember, evaporation is just a physical change. Water that evaporates is still water. If you look at individual water molecules, you can't tell whether they're liquid or a gas. What makes it a gas? A population of molecules? In other words, what's the difference between a gas and a liquid? Not necessarily. Particle distancing, spacing, is what makes it a gas. The particles in a gas are much more distantly spaced from each other than in a liquid. But they're still exactly the same molecule. They haven't changed substance. Well, you have a population in the liquid phase. And if you think about trying to get one of those molecules to go off onto its own into the gas phase, which is what evaporation is, first of all, you're not a likely candidate if you're one of the molecules way down here in at depth, right? Because evaporation happens at the surface. So, first of all, you have to be, if you're trying to evaporate, in a sense, you have to be pretty close to the surface to be one of those lucky few. But also, if you consider just the ones near the surface, water molecules, which are the ones that are the most likely to actually escape? Just in common sense terms. Don't put this too deeply into physics. What? Yeah, but I'm saying if we just restrict our attention to the ones at the top, which of the ones at the top are the most likely? Okay, now, of those, which ones are most likely? The ones that are moving the fastest. Right? Because to escape, you have to break those hydrogen bonds that are kind of holding you in the liquid state. Right? Now, think about what I said temperature is. What is temperature? The average speed of the population of particles, right? So the fastest ones are the most likely to leave and go off into the gas phase. If you get rid of them, and recalculate the average for the ones that are remaining back in the liquid phase, what happens to that average? Yeah, you've removed the fastest ones because they've gone off on their own. They're no longer part of the liquid population. And so now you have a new average speed of the liquid particles. What happens to that average compared to what it was before? It goes down, right. You've gotten rid of the fastest ones in the population.
Does that mean it gets colder?
It gets colder, exactly. This is exactly why evaporation cools the liquid that is being evaporated. And somewhat surprisingly, if you actually think about it, or maybe it surprises you, not only does the evaporation cool the liquid that's left behind, it also cools the air into which that evaporation is occurring, which is exactly why evaporative coolers work if you have one in your house. Right? You evaporate water at the evaporative cooler, that cools the air. But if you went up into the evaporative cooler and felt that water, it would also be cold. Now, I think I'm out of time, so I can't explain why, but I will next time.